You're watching a Highwire Media podcast. Welcome to another episode of Murder Monday on the True Crime Never Sleeps show. As always, I'm your host, Larry Lease. On today's episode, we're diving into the secret life of an insurance broker that turns to murder. Let me know your thoughts on this case in the comments section below. And as always, thank you so much for watching and listening. Let's dive right in. I think it's safe to say that most people have secrets, little things they've done that they don't intend to share with anyone else. Whether it's a small thing about themselves, or even a bigger thing, most people have something they probably plan to take to the grave. But sometimes those secrets do not get buried along with us, especially when death culminates in a murder investigation. That's when our secrets matter the most. What wasn't someone telling their friends or family? Who were they talking to that no one ever knew about? And could that have led to their premature death? No matter how big or small, a victim's secrets are often the biggest clue in a murder investigation. At least, that's what TV leads us to believe. But sometimes secrets are nothing more than a scandalous distraction, one that forces us to ignore reality, because secrets aren't always deadly. Oftentimes, the answer to murder lies in the mundane. So let's dial back the clock to the year 2007 as we travel back to St. Charles, Missouri. Just west of St. Louis, St. Charles is the suburban little town mostly filled with commuters, the sort of place where people have spent generations, where everyone knows everyone, is generally considered a peaceful, safe little community. It also happens to be where 48-year-old Bob Eidman and his wife Diane call home. Now everyone who knows Bob says that he is a teddy bear of a guy, only about 5'6", but he has a huge personality. Incredibly bubbly and lovable, he's always cracking jokes. In fact, it seems like Bob was a bit of a class clown growing up, too. When he wasn't pulling off pranks, he was testing the boundaries of authority. Every summer, he was having to make up classwork in summer school. But Bob was also easily distracted by girls growing up. And shortly after graduating from high school was when Bob met the woman that he would spend the rest of his life with. And that was Diane Bowling. Now, not only was Diane a bit taller than Bob, she matched his sharp-witted personality, too. She can go toe-to-toe with Bob and put him in his place. She could put him in his place, and that was something Bob loved about Diane. So, come to the year 2007, they've been married for 20 years. Though they never had any children together, they seem to have built a nice life for themselves. Diane managed the kitchen at a local hospital while Bob ran his own business. He was an insurance agent with his own office in a strip mall, along a busy route that ran into St. Louis. But lately, Bob's business in 2007 had fallen on hard times. He wasn't getting as many clients as he used to, which was starting to stress him out a little bit. By June 2007, he basically thought he was going to stay afloat for a few more months before he'd have to close up shop entirely. But on the 8th of that month in June, Bob faced the unthinkable. It was a beautiful, sunny Friday, about 80 degrees, when Bob opened up his shop, took a seat at his desk around 11 a.m. A mail carrier stopped by his office on her usual route, and that's when she saw the unthinkable. She dropped everything and began running up the street calling for help. She flagged down a police officer who happened to be passing by and told them that the man who ran the insurance company over there was lying on the floor motionless. He had blood covering his face. So when more officers are called to the scene, they find Bob has been shot. There are 3 bullet wounds on his head, or on his body, excuse me. One on his chin, one on his neck, and the fatal shot being the one through his eye. Now all of them appear to have been fired at close range, and all from the same gun. Though there weren't any other signs of a struggle from what police could tell. However, they realize at the crime scene, Bob's wallet is missing, and sources who know him say he always kept his wallet in his back pocket. So as they are sweeping the crime scene for clues, they gather any ammunition casings and fingerprints they can find, and they actually do something pretty smart. They cut out the fabric around Bob's back pocket, where he usually kept his wallet, and they did this in order to search it for touch DNA. Because if someone took the wallet out of his back pocket, maybe they left something behind. Now it doesn't take long for local reporters to catch wind of this crime. Homicides only happen about once a year in St. Charles, so this is a pretty big local story. But Diane, Bob's wife, hears that something has happened down at Bob's office, so she rushes to the scene. When she gets there, she tells police, "I've been trying to reach Bob all day. He never answered his phone." Is everything all right? Though by this point, Diane must know nothing is all right, and it's there, at the scene of the crime. The police break the news to Diane. No, Bob has been murdered. Your husband has been murdered. Now, as I mentioned, murder isn't something the local police deal with a whole lot here in St. Charles, so they call in the help of the Major Case Squad. And the Major Case Squad has a pretty great track record. They claim that 80% of their cases get solved, and one of the first things that police start to investigate is what could have motivated someone to show up and shoot Bob in his office in broad daylight. Well, they think the answer to that might actually lie in Bob's business itself. Remember, Bob was an insurance salesman, but his clientele was sort of on the fringe. Bob dealt with the kind of people who were high-risk drivers, people with bad credit, and challenging histories. Basically, people who would have a hard time getting insurance through traditional methods. And since a lot of people would try and pay with bad checks that would bounce, Bob was only really accepting cash at this time, which meant Bob's office had a lot of cash in it at any given moment. And apparently, Bob didn't have a lot of that money locked up in a safe either. He just kept it in a locked drawer in his desk. Now, whether or not any clients of his knew that, witnesses are unsure. But when police go to that desk drawer, they find there's only $200 inside. That's a heck of a lot less than what Bob was supposed to be keeping in there.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Granger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRANGER, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
So between that and his missing wallet, police are thinking, is this a robbery? But why wouldn't they take all the cash then? Why leave 200? Plus, there doesn't seem to have been any forced entry into the place. None of the typical signs you might expect if someone was trying to break in and rob this place. So police have to consider another possibility. After speaking with Bob's family and friends, they learn pretty quickly about the difficult times that Bob has fallen on, that he was just 3 months away from basically shutting his business down. So they also wonder, what if Bob had taken a hit out on his own life? Could that have been something he was capable of or even considered? But that same day, police do get a break in the case, one that at least gives them some hint as to who shot Bob. So investigators have been going around trying to collect security footage from the area at the time of the crime. And they find one taken from a Mexican grocery store really close to Bob's office. It has a pretty good view of the front door of Bob's insurance company. It even captured the mail carrier running away from the scene that day. But what it also got was a white Ford Focus driving past Bob's business twice that morning. Once at 10:50, and then again at 10:54. Only that second time, it was much slower. It honestly looked like the Ford Focus was looking for something. That's just 6 minutes before Bob was found dead. Now the police are feeling pretty confident this car either saw something or was involved somehow, so they need to find out who owns it. Problem is, there's about 5,000 white Ford Focuses on the road in Missouri at this time, so it's kind of like a needle in a haystack. But what seems like that same day, they seem to catch a really lucky break, because they discover, not too far from Bob's business, a white car that has been crashed and abandoned off the side of a nearby road. And inside of this white car is Bob Eidman's business card. Now you have to imagine what that's like for police. Okay, so they're doing this, they find the security footage, they're like, oh, this is our answer. Then they see the white car, they're like, shoot, we're kind of back to square one. How are we going to find this? And then they get a call that a white car has crashed in Bob's card is inside. Now the police locate the owner of this vehicle. It's a man named Travis Ensley. When he's called in for questioning, he's actually shocked to learn he's not just there because he abandoned his crashed vehicle and falsely reported it stolen. He's there because he is a person of interest in a murder investigation. And even worse, when they pull Travis in, he has blood on his shirt. Travis is like, whoa, 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 this is all a huge misunderstanding. And he says he had been needing new insurance on his car, hence Bob's business card in his vehicle. So he says he went to Bob, he liked the guy, even gave him a good rate. But the night before Travis was questioned, he went out, had a few drinks, crashed his newly insured car, and drunkenly, Travis stumbled back home that night with a broken nose, and then woke up the next morning to notice his car wasn't there. He'd forgotten that he crashed it the night before. He called his new insurance and reported it stolen, before finally remembering, oh, actually, I think I left it on an embankment not far from my apartment. So police think this is a bit far-fetched, but the blood on Travis's shirt does turn out to be his own, and Travis's alibi holds up as well. He wasn't at the scene of Bob's crime when it happened, which means Travis might have looked like the ideal suspect. Police are kind of back to square one. And before we continue our story, we'd like to, again, thank our sponsor for NordVPN for sponsoring this episode. Let's be real, we're online all the time. Whether you're streaming, banking, or doom scrolling at 2 a.m., your data is out there. And these days, hackers, advertisers, and even your internet provider want a piece of that pie. And that's when NordVPN steps in. NordVPN is one of the fastest and most reliable VPNs in the world. With just one click, you can protect your devices with military-grade encryption. Think of it as putting your online activity in an armored tank that no one's getting in. Worried about public Wi-Fi at coffee shops or airports? Don't be. NordVPN shields you from sketchy networks and keeps your personal info, like passwords and credit cards, safe from prying eyes. Want to stream shows that aren't available in your country? You're going to love this. NordVPN lets you access content from over 60 countries, so you can binge international Netflix, Hulu, or BBC iPlayer with zero buffering. Plus, with threat protection, NordVPN now blocks ads, trackers, and malware before they even hit your browser. It's like antivirus and privacy armor all rolled into one. Right now, NordVPN is offering an exclusive deal just for our subscribers. Use the link in the description today and get a huge discount on a 2-year plan plus 4 bonus months free. That's 28 months of digital peace of mind. And there's zero risk thanks to Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Try it out, and if it's not for you, no problem. Protect your connection, explore the internet without limits. Just use the link in the description and take control of your online life today. And now, let's get back to our story. Though, as always, there's one person that can't be ignored in a murder investigation, and that is Diane. So the spouse, and while I don't have any initial reason to believe Diane was involved, they ask her a few questions to rule her out anyway. Though, the more they start talking to Diane, the more they wonder, okay, is she actually involved? Police's suspicion kind of start from the moment Diane actually showed up at the crime scene that day, because some say that Diane, despite hearing the news that her husband's just been murdered, didn't really seem too surprised or emotional in the moment. But that's not the only thread they're following when it comes to Diane. She too tells police they were facing some financial issues. So it's not like Bob was keeping this a secret from Diane. Yep, there wasn't a lot of cash coming in. The business was floundering and they were having a hard time paying the bills. And there's a couple of red flags that go off for detectives at this point. One of them being the fact that Diane seems to have a bad memory. Only when it comes to certain things like her social security number, and whether or not Bob has any life insurance policies. What she seemingly forgets to tell police is Bob did have his own, and Diane was about to receive more than $300,000 after Bob's death. That's a lot of money considering the situation they're in as well. Though it's not until police start checking with insurance companies that they actually realize this. Excuse me. Diane never tells them herself, so of course, because she keeps this from them, it makes her look suspicious. And that's not the worst of it. See, Diane has some family secrets as well, one that doesn't exactly look great for her when she mentions them to detectives. On the day of Bob's death, Diane speaks with a female detective and sort of opens up to her, and she says, "Look, don't take this as a confession, but this same thing happened to my dad." And here's what she means. When Diane was 26 years old, so about 2 decades prior to this, her father was working as a St. Louis police officer, but on the morning of April 6, 1984, at around 2:30 a.m., her mother dials 911, claims someone broke into the house, stole his gun, and shot him to death. Now, when police get to the house, they find Diane's mother, Lenore. She has no tears, her hair is fully done, and when police question her, she's casually smoking a cigarette. She has no emotion. Sound a little familiar? Well, Lenore tells the police that there's been a man following them lately, and he's been leaving notes at the house, including one on the night Diane's father died that said, "This is for what you did to me." But as police really get into their investigation, they learn that there was no forced entry into the home. The door to the garage where Lenore said the man broke in was deadbolted shut, among many other clues. And eventually, it was Lenore, Diane's mother, who was charged with murdering her husband, Diane's father. So you can kind of see why Diane mentions this to police, because it would be suspicious if she didn't say, "Hey, my mom was arrested and charged for shooting my dad in the face, and now my husband has been shot in the face." And also, maybe she's just taken after her mom. So the similarities are a little glaring, especially when they hear that Bob was scared to death of Lenore. That's his mother-in-law. Particularly because she was actually living in their home as she awaited trial. And rightfully so. I mean, he had an accused murderer sleeping under the same roof as him. So Bob was always locking their bedroom door. He was afraid to be alone in the house with his mother-in-law. But in a pretty shocking turn of events, Lenore was actually found not guilty by a jury. She was acquitted for that crime. I'm not sure how this entire thing affected Bob and Diane's marriage, but the verdict probably didn't put him at ease, and it unfortunately wasn't giving police any confidence in Diane either. So the next time the police speak with Diane, they ask her, "Hey, why don't you just take a polygraph test so we can clear your name?" So Diane agrees, and she tells police she has absolutely nothing to hide. She had nothing to do with her husband's murder, and her results come back inconclusive. She doesn't fail, but they can't get a read on her. So the next step is for police to get a closer look at Bob's personal life, and Diane agrees to let them take his computer for analysis. And what they find there honestly changes the course of the investigation. So one of the first things they find on Bob's computer is that he's been visiting homosexual websites, and not just porn. It's more like hookup sites. Think Grindr before Grindr. So that leads detectives to subpoena Bob's phone records, because now they're wondering, is this a secret love affair that went sideways? Someone looking to blackmail or even extort Bob? And when they look into his call history, they find that Bob has been chatting with one person pretty consistently for a while. Someone who lives out of town, about 3 hours away. It's a man named Drew Smith. Here's the thing though, Drew and Bob weren't just having some long distance emotional affair. Apparently, they'd meet up in motels closer to Drew's hometown whenever Bob could get away. So police think, we gotta talk to Drew, obviously, because he's basically Bob's lover. And honestly, what they uncover is pretty heartbreaking, because not only did Bob feel like he was living this double life, it turns out, according to Drew, he and Bob really were in love. They spoke to each other several times a day, and I guess Bob was telling himself he wanted to eventually just come out to his wife and then have a relationship with Drew. Drew even had a tattoo for Bob on his arm. Meanwhile, Bob had been keeping little souvenirs from their meetups and dates together. Now, Drew has an alibi for where he was during the time of Bob's death, and he passes a polygraph, so he's kind of ruled out as the suspect pretty quickly. But police discover something else. The secret life that Bob was living? Well, it wasn't so secret after all. Bob's wife had stumbled across some of the emails Bob had been sending to Drew. So she knew, basically. She knew about this love affair. And when she confronted Bob about it, he apparently denied it all. But Diane was like, "No, this is real." So now the focus returns back to Diane. Could she have been angry about this relationship? She maybe hired someone to, I don't know, but I don't see that happening. Could be wrong. The problem is, though, there's only circumstantial evidence when it comes to Diane. Nothing concrete whatsoever connecting her physically to the crime. So Bob's case starts to run cold until about 2 years later when St. Charles police get a call from a DNA investigative team. So remember how the police cut out Bob's pocket where his wallet usually was? The thinking was that if someone yanked his wallet from his pocket, there would be touch DNA. Well, in 2009, investigators learned that the DNA they pulled from that pocket finally has a match. And it's someone the police would have never guessed. The man's name is Paul White. He was a customer at Bob's insurance agency. There were even files on Bob's desk when he died with Paul's name on them. So, it's a current client. They also discovered that a month or so after the murder, Paul White was a passenger in a car that was stopped for a traffic violation. It was an expired registration. The driver's name was Cleo Hines. And Cleo Hines drove a light-colored Ford Focus, just like the one that was seen driving past Bob's office in the minutes before and after the murder. Now, Paul is pretty easy to find because he's in prison when his name finally pops up in this case. It's for a completely unrelated charge, though, for forgery, actually. But that's not the only thing on Paul White's rap sheet. I mean, this guy's been charged with a bunch of different things over the years, mostly forgery and theft. I don't think murder was on the list yet. However, when police show up to the prison to question Paul, he completely denies having anything to do with Bob's murder. Actually says it was physically impossible for his DNA to be on that pair of pants. So with Paul not willing to show any of his cards, detectives realize they need to pivot. And now they are looking at the man who was driving the car during that traffic violation, the owner of the white Ford Focus, Cleo. What they learn is Cleo was living with Paul before his arrest. So they think, all right, we're starting to get somewhere. They have this relationship, like a personal relationship at least. Maybe we should bring in Cleo for questioning. Maybe he'll flip on Paul. I mean, maybe he was the getaway driver. And almost the second he sits his butt down in the hot seat, he cracks like an egg. He's like, yeah, okay, yeah, I was involved in Bob's murder. But I was just the getaway driver, I swear. Excuse me. In fact, he doubles down saying, quote, no, Paul actually forced me to do this. He literally held me at gunpoint and made me drive him there and back. Cleo claims that the night before, Paul had lost over $1,200 at a casino and was desperate to make up for it. He told Cleo he knew a guy that kept a bunch of cash at his business on site and they were going to go rob him. This was literally a day of decision. He said Paul had actually woken him up that morning with a pistol to his head, forcing him to get up and do it. When Cleo was asked what kind of gun Paul was wielding that day, Cleo said it was a 9mm Glock. This is the same exact kind of gun that was used to kill Bob. So police now know that this is likely the truth, or at least Paul and Cleo are in fact involved in Bob's murder. Maybe we don't know the specifics. Was he actually forced? But they believe now that these are the two guys. But the entire time, Cleo was insisting, I never got out of the car. All I did was drive Paul to the scene, got out, got the cash, got back in, and I drove away. So now police realize we've got to go back to Paul and let him know Cleo's turned on him. And this time, not knowing that his buddy is speaking out against him, Paul says, okay, I'm going to confess. I did kill Bob that day, but I didn't do it alone. Paul says that on the morning of their crime, both he and Cleo lost money at the casino. They went around town looking for people to rob and at one point considered targeting people coming out of Walmart. But when they realized there were too many cameras, Paul came up with another idea. They should just go after his insurance agent, Bob. Paul knew Bob kept a bunch of cash on site because his wife had seen it when she went to sign for her insurance policy about a month or two earlier. And then Paul says the two of them drove to Bob's office together. They both got out of the car. They both put on masks and went into Bob's office. When they demanded he give them the cash, Bob gave them the $300 that he had on hand. But when they demanded more, and Bob said he didn't have it, they ripped his wallet out of his pants in a spur of the moment decision, decided to shoot Bob several times, and left. Now I will say Paul changes his story a lot during his confessions, so this is the best version I kind of wrapped up for you. But I will add this: neither Paul nor Cleo ever mentioned Diane. They were both asked individually if they had ever heard of Diane, and they were like, no, not really. I mean, we know that's his wife. Which means Diane, who's probably the main person of interest in this case, simply because of her family's history, what happened between her dad and mom, her not-so-good memory, her husband's affair. What a coincidence, right? Well, she's cleared, all because of a little touch of DNA on a pair of pants. Like, literally, because they cut out the pocket, they figured out who it was. This is the issue with crime scenes. You would hope that they could go around to every square footage of a building and test everywhere, but that's not. You have to test the most common places, a place someone would touch or grab. So it was so smart for them to test that pocket. Now, Paul White and Cleo Hines are both charged with first-degree murder and first-degree robbery. Paul pleads not guilty to the charges. His trial only lasts 3 days. The jury's deliberations are quick, and just 2.5 hours later, they come back with a verdict of guilty on all counts. He's later sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now, Cleo, on the other hand, chose to enter an Alford plea. Basically, he's not officially saying he did it, but he has evidence against him and he doesn't want to go to trial, so he'll take an Alford plea. So Cleo gets a lesser conviction than Paul does because of this. He gets second-degree murder with first-degree robbery, sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole. Now, unfortunately, because of the circumstances surrounding Bob's death, there is something that is so sad and devastating. On top of someone being a victim of murder, everything about their life gets put on blast. So these secrets that Bob had, he doesn't get to take it to the grave with him. And that's something I find difficult to swallow. That sometimes we dig into people's personal lives in order to find out who killed them. However, in Bob's case, none of that even needed to be exposed to learn what really happened that day. I mean, him having his having this affair, you know, having a man that was in love with him, was a huge part of this case. It was the number one reason Diane was a suspect. Just to find out that it had nothing to do with that, which is hard because I do get the other side of it, that statistically it usually is a spouse. So to them, they're like, we have to dig. However, at the end of the day, Paul and Cleo stole a lot more from Bob than just $300 and his life. They stole Bob's privacy. That's something Bob and his family will never give back. And with that, that is the murder case of Bob Eichmann. Let me know your thoughts on this case in the comment section below. And if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS or just scan the QR code right there. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We will see you next time.